Hi, everyone. Welcome back. We are in part two here of a session that we began on Monday, focusing on selections from Vayikra Rabbah, the art of interpretation. And again, as we've been doing all week, focusing both on the substance of what various midrashim have to offer, but also a sense of how midrash works. The idea that midrash is where close attention to the text an interest in an idea meet in the middle. A proper understanding of Midrash is really, I think, understanding how you get a generative, exegetical, spiritual experience that we know of as Midrash, that comes from a place of thinking about something and reading, always in some meaningful measure, both of them at the same time. And that means that a Midrash properly understood always has to be tethered to some point or idea that someone felt it was worthwhile to articulate, and also a text to which I am tethered, to which I am accountable, the prism through which whatever light I'm shining must pass. So in that context, we saw a number of midrashim that played that out. We talked about what it means to look out at a world where people observe mitzvot at great sacrifice and investment, and to appreciate that. And we talked about appreciating the ways in which people's fates are not necessarily sealed, and there's ways back through repentance, and in particular on both the individual and national level. And we played that piece out. Today, we're going to move on to two other passages. If we have time, we'll do a third very, very quickly just to get a sense of it, but I'm assuming we'll only have time for two. All right, so the idea we're going to start with today is the perhaps simple, perhaps controversial idea that mitzvot are a privilege and not a burden. I remember actually once a family friend years ago, having a conversation with him that I appreciated and it rattled me. He said he was someone, he was actually born in France and came to the US, I think, as a teenager, but retained a very strong sense of kind of European Jewish history and the past, and always looked at Jewish life in America with kind of an attitude of, yeah, this is fine. You don't know how, you know, good and easy you have it. And one of the manifestations of that was, I remember him saying to me once, God, I must have been like 16 or something. I remember him saying, you know, observing the mitzvot is a luxury. And I said, what do you mean? It's a luxury. It's an expectation. So I'm good. They said it's a luxury. I feel lucky that I'm able to keep the mitzvot. You know, in many times and places, that actually just wasn't reasonable. In a way, without debating, I still don't really agree with him 100%, but I appreciate what he was articulating. There's a piece that goes back to the section we did on Monday, the sabbatical year observers in the tax environment of the Roman Empire, unyielding taxes, you know, reflecting the ways in which, if not a luxury, it's a privilege to be able to observe mitzvot under less rather than more duress. But there's also sort of this question of, what are mitzvot? Are mitzvot fundamentally a burden that we have, which, okay, it's better if the burden's lighter as opposed to heavier, or is the sign that we have obligations itself actually a kind of a sense of privilege? Here, too, I'll just name right up front, this is for sure also in dialogue, the text we'll look at here, in dialogue with an emergent, increasingly powerful Pauline Christianity that is, if it has not yet taken over the empire, it's hard to exactly date when all these texts get put together. It's certainly on the ascendancy. And the notion that mitzvot are actually a burden and you need grace to release you from the law is definitely an idea that is competing with the approach in this text. All right, as always, we got to start with the text that we are reading. And that here is from the prophet Habakkuk. Habakkuk is read once a year on Shavuot, the second day. If you live in Israel, you never read Habakkuk. So perhaps for that reason alone, it's worth it to be in the diaspora. You get here actually a line that does actually feature even in the Haftarah on the second day of Shavuot. It's as follows. Amad vayemoded eretz, ra'a vayater goyin, vayitpotzetsu arare ad, shachu givot olam, halichot olam lo. Is the JPS 1917 translation. When he stands, God, he makes the earth shake. That is to say, Amad, kishe Amad, when God stands, moded, in the sense of kind of a trembling. Ra'a, when God just glances at the earth, vayater goyim, he makes nations tremble. So goyim here is nations, and vayater here, there's a dagesh in the taf, which is hiding what seems to be a nun of the shoresh, of the root, like right, vayapel ala vayamot is from the root nafal. So vayater is really like vayanter. Linater bahen al haaretz is how the Torah describes certain insects that have joints in their legs that enable them to leap. Linater bahen, grasshoppers. Okay, grasshoppers hop because they have these joints. Linater, they are able to leap. Ra'a vayater goyim, sends as God glances at the earth and makes the nations jump up in fear. The age-old mountains are shattered, the primeval hills sink low. His are the ancient. Okay, ra'a vayater goyim. We're now going to see a midrash that's going to read this very differently in two forms. First, it's going to start with Amad vayemoded eretz. Not as when God stands, God makes the earth shake, which you can see from the biblical parallelism, right? The shaking, the trembling, the explosion, all of that. These are things that when God encounters something, they have this kind of kinetic reaction. Instead, Amad vayemoded is going to be read as God stood up at one point, vayemoded, not as an intransitive verb applied to eretz, the land, shake, right? Or somehow God makes the earth shake, but vayemoded eretz, God does an act of midida to the land. What is midida? Measurement. And then ra'a, not God glances, but God looked. God saw something, and as a result, vayater goyim, where instead of reading it from the root nun taf resh, we're going to read it from the root lihatir, to permit or to release. All right, that's just the foreshadowing of where they're going to go, but now let's read the midrash and see how it plays out. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai patach. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai opens his discourse with the following verse. Amad vayemoded eretz ra'a vayater goyim, the verse from Habakkuk. Madad hakadosh baruch hu bechol haumot velo matza uma shehi re'uya lekabel et haTorah ela Yisrael. We're going to get a whole series of statements that are parallel to this, so let's just understand the first one, and then everything else will fall into line. God measured the earth, okay? God measured the earth and found that none of the nations of the earth were actually worthy to receive the Torah except Israel. So this is a somewhat familiar trope, the idea that God maybe shops the Torah around. There's other versions of that. But here, right, the notion of God measured and did not find worthy, we see here, right, the Torah is being cast as a gift that you have to be worthy of. Right off the bat, not having the Torah and not having the Torah's expectations is clearly lower on the rung of the ladder, on a lower rung of the ladder than the recipient. We're not even yet talking about burdens, but we know the Torah contains all kinds of burdens, all kinds of mitzvot. God measures, amad v'yamoded eretz, God is looking for someone who is worthy. And now we get that for all the other details. Umadar HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chol ha-dorot, melo matzah dor ha-ra'ui l'kabel at ha-torah, l'dor ha-midbar. The generation of the desert, measured as the only worthy one. Madar HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chol ha-arim, melo matzah har she-tishre shechina alav el ha-har ha-moriah. Searched all the mountains in the world, the only mountain worthy of the divine presence in a permanent way is Mount Moriah, Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Matzah Madar HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chol ha-yarot. The only place that was worthy of a temple was Jerusalem. Searched all the mountains now for one on which the Torah would be given, only Mount Sinai, literally measured up. The land of Israel was the only fit inheritance for God's people. Many acts of measuring. Who measures up? Hada udichtiv, amad vayimoded eretz. Okay? God stood, took measure of the earth, and thereby made decisions. Okay, so that's part one of our Habakkuk. So far, I wouldn't say something too radical or dramatic. It's like, yeah. Actually, it was a good thing to be picked by God for this mission and all of its components. Okay. But now, Ra'av Ayater Goyim. And a word of context here for where this appears. This is from Parashat Shmini. Parashat Shmini, at the end, gets into the laws of Kashrut, the forbidden animals. Okay, and in that sense, this discussion, as you'll see at the end, of the burdens of Torah goes to a place where, as you experience in the world as a Jew, there are some things that restrict you that don't restrict other people. Right? In other words, there are other things in the world where it's like, I do this, you do that. But the fundamental experience for most Jews, certainly Jews, in a Christianizing environment of observing the dietary laws, is they are a restriction and a burden and a limitation that others do not have. Okay? So in that context, we get the reading of Ra'av Ayater Goyim. Again, plain sense made the nations leap in fright, but it's going to be read here in the sense of heter, permitting. Ula bira b'shem Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Le'echad sheyatza lagoren v'chalbo v'chamoro imo. You want to understand what's going on here? Someone went to their threshing floor with a dog and a donkey. Their dog, their donkey. Hidin l'chamoro chamesh se'in u'lechalbo shtayim. So he's got seven se'ah. A se'ah is like a little more than 13 liters. All right? You know, meaningful amount of grain. Got work hard, you gather in all the things with the threshing floor, you got seven sa'ah, you got to take home. So he puts five on the donkey and two on the dog. Why? A donkey is a beast of burden. Okay, so of course you got to put more on the donkey, but the dog should be able to take something. V'ayahu to'akel of malchit, but the dog is panting. Oh, this is so hard, hard. Ha'avir mimenu achat. Takes one of the sa'af, so now it's 6-1, and dog's still panting. Takes both of them off. The dog now has nothing, and is still panting, while the donkey's got all seven. Amar le, ta'un let at ta'un, not malchit. Basically turns to the dog and says, what's wrong with you? You got nothing. You're carrying nothing, and you're still panting. Kach, afilu sheva mitzvot shekiblu aleihem b'nei Noach, kevan shelo yachlu la'amod b'hem, amdu ufrakum al Yisrael. So the nations were given seven basic laws, the seven Noahide laws, basic expectations of civilization. When they could not handle even those seven, even the reduced load of two Sa'in, they took them and unloaded them onto Israel. Israel was, of course, already burdened with those seven, but there's a notion here of they wash their hands of responsibility for them. It's going to be the Jews' responsibility. Okay, so just let's pause here for a minute. It's not such a nice metaphor, right? The Gentiles are the dog in this metaphor. The Jews are the donkey, not that that's so glorified, but I think fair to say better to be a donkey than a dog just on the imagery alone, certainly in rabbinic literature. But as I said, what you have going on here is a playing with the imagery and experience of burden. There's a sense that the mitzvot are a burden, right? They are actually something you have to carry. They weigh something. It can be hard for people to carry them. But at the end of the day, the narrative being offered here is that it's a greater privilege to have that burden. It's not something you are looking to unload. And there's a kind of shame cast here on the Gentiles who are unable, unwilling to fulfill even the seven mitzvot. Now, if it's directed at Romans, a Roman Empire, a sense of a corrupt regime that they don't believe in, and ongoing resentment for the end of Jewish sovereignty at the hands of the Romans? Is this directed at Christians and a kind of antinomian theory of you've been freed from the law and even the language of Amdu Ufrakum al Yisrael? I'm not claiming there's a direct engagement with or quoting of Paul, but the notion that perhaps maybe the Jews are obligated in the mitzvot, but you know, the Gentiles are not, and there's a kind of preaching of that in that way. Paul surely would have taken issue with the notion that he was not, you know, advancing the basic decency that is demanded by the Sheva Mitzvot. But the thing I think you have to understand here, if we want to get to the idea, right, that's meeting the text in the middle here, this text is very clearly dealing with an environment where mitzvot are being argued to be and perhaps experienced as a burden. In the darker version of the story I started with, yeah, it's a luxury to keep mitzvot, meaning like pain in the neck. If you can do it, fine. If you're able to be wealthy enough to pull it off and do it comfortably, fine. But yeah, fundamentally, it's a pain in the neck. This midrash, I would contend to you, lives in that world. And its counter idea is no. I want to advance the notion that that burden is actually a privilege. And the text that's meeting in the middle is the slightly odd and perhaps obscure word vayater. Vayater goyim. Not causing the nations to tremble or leap, but rather permitting the nations, releasing the nations. God released the nations from their basic Noahide obligations. Amar bitanchum bar chanilai, lirofe shenichnas levaker shnei cholim. And now we get even more aggressive. You want to know what this parsha about forbidden animals is really about? A doctor goes in to visit two patients. One of them has a chance of living, and one of them does not have a chance of living. The one that has a chance of living gets a doctor's order of eat this, don't eat this, I want you to take care of yourself this way, that way. And the one that does not have a chance of living, God says, do whatever you want. Eat whatever you want. So the nations of the world who don't have a share in the world to come, ki yerek esav natati lachem et kol, quoting back from Noah, where Noah is allowed to eat anything. Absolutely anything on earth, other than the blood of an animal while attached, right? But basically can eat anything. Why are they granted that? Because who cares? It actually just doesn't matter. Whereas Israel, the Jews, who are destined for the world to come, to them it says, Zot ha'chaya asher tochelu mikol ha'behemah asher lach. These are the animals that you shall eat from everything domesticated that crawls the earth, that roams the earth. Okay, it's a tough text, right? In the sense of this is not the kind of text that I recommend or would be appropriate to go off, quoting in Jewish-Gentile dialogue today, right? Or the way I would hope we would not sort of think more broadly about what's the connection between a particular Jewish outlook and a more kind of embeddedness in a broader universal humanity. But Midrashim like this are extremely important to kind of understand and confront as part of a very long legacy of Jewish texts in the context of really being bullied in a deep way in a larger environment about the mitzvot as being burdensome, antiquated, taking you out of a relationship with a broader humanity, and fighting back for a certain kind of dignity of, no, the fact that these things are expected of me actually matters. And taking it out of the Jewish-Gentile context mm-hmm. for a minute, that's the piece I also find kind of intense and important here, which I think we still struggle with tremendously in our contemporary environment. How do we relate to telling people to do things, right? When you tell someone to do something, or someone else tells you to do something, there's actually two fundamental ways of experiencing that. One way is you're bossing me around. You're making my life harder. You're just telling me no, no, no. You're not letting me reach my sort of full expression of self. That, of course, can be true, right? There's no question that there are things that can hem us in that can yield those kinds of results. It's also the case that you can look at expectations as a sign of respect. We only really expect things of people, really demand things of people when we expect it of them because we think that they're capable of it and we think they have a certain role and destiny and function to play in the world, and therefore we demand things of them. Right, the years ago, Karen Hughes, was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush, coined the phrase, the soft bigotry of low expectations. Right, that phrase is a notion that when you actually don't expect something of someone, there's a way in which you're being easy on them, but in a way that actually reveals your prejudice. This is fighting for that kind of attitude towards Torah in an environment that's hostile towards it. And it is indeed sort of picking out and pointing a finger at Gentiles and some, again, I think there's definitely overtones of a certain kind of Jewish-Christian mode of thought here that's emerged, that wants to see law and mitzvot as burden. And while I think almost subversively acknowledging the burden with the donkey metaphor here, nonetheless wearing it as a badge of pride and saying, you know why I was given all this? Because I can handle it. I think there's a redemptive kind of more universal pathway out of a midrash like this that says, well, actually, that may be actually what Torah is trying to create in the world. It has sort of uneven successes along the way, but it's trying to create a world in which we can expect things of people, and then people rise to those expectations, right? Now, again, that's coming back to that verse, Ra'av Ayater Goyim, and that's where we've got this creative reading again of, again, a verse in Habakkuk, the plain sense of which was, wow, God makes, somehow shows up in the world and freaks it out, to God showing up, making an assessment, who can I count on here? Who measures up? Who can I give this task to? And this midrash is saying, the Jews pass that test. And the world of people who observe the mitzvot and the Torah are living up to that divine expectation. Okay, that's our midrash number one. Okay, let's go on to number two. Here we need to do a little more Tanakh homework. The idea here is economic justice as a matter of life and death. I find this to be a pretty stunning, not just midrash, but sort of pulling together of different strands of text. And we got to do the background of the text in order to really understand the midrash. That, of course, is another part of this, is what makes midrash so challenging to teach. It works, I don't want to say it works better, but it's almost like it's designed for someone who's carrying all of the Bible in their back pocket. So sometimes to simulate that experience, we have to do a little bit of our homework and background, at least those of us like me that do not carry all of that in our back pocket. And therefore, we have to see. Yeah, just one, because it's come up twice here before we jump into this. A few comments about what about righteous Gentiles having a place in the world to come, and how does that interact with this? So I think you could say there's non-unity on that. I think the harmonistic reading here would be, yeah, righteous Gentiles, sure. but they're looking out at a world and being like, that's a few exceptions, which I think is actually a correct, right? I think for the most part, without having any ability to second guess it, for the most part, the rabbinic experience of the world seems to be like, the modern Jewish assessment of Germans in World War II. Of course there are righteous people. Yes, we'll honor them. We'll plant them a tree. We'll give them honorary Israeli citizenship, right? Whatever it is. Like, that's a gift. But the overall system was corrupt, murdered us, etc. That, I think, is the overall picture. So when we say Lo Da'olam here, we're not saying ipso facto you're a Gentile. There's no way. It's a broad assessment, right, of the world that's out there. So I think it can be consistent with that broader view. And, as a side comment, I think it's interesting to think in the ways, in certain ways, of how, to the extent we have a different take on the world, it's less that we are actually fundamentally working with different categories, and instead we're working with different percentages. All right, but that's for another time.
Okay.
Here's a story from Shmuel Bet. There was a famine during the reign of David. Year after year, for 3 years, David seeks out God, and God answers. Here's why the famine's coming. El Shaul ve'el Beit Adamim, al asher emit et ha-givonim. It's because of Shaul, and your predecessor as king, and his blood guilt for killing the Givonim. Killing some of the Gibeonites. Okay. David calls the Givonim and says to them, right, speaks to them, and now parenthetical, the Givonim were not Israelites. They were remnants from the indigenous people that had been dispossessed and mostly killed by the Israelites. But the Israelites had sworn to them not to kill them. We'll come back to that in a minute. You got some group of Amorites, of indigenous people who normally would have been wiped out as part of the conquest of the land of Canaan, to whom the Israelites made a vow. And that's how they stuck around. Nonetheless, Shaul, at one point, tried to wipe them out in his zeal for the people of Israel and Judah. Shaul violates some sacred oath that the Israelites have made to this minority in their midst. And God says, that's why you're having a famine, because there is some unrequited guilt here devolving on the monarchy, the people, the land, for having violated this oath towards these non-Israelites. So David goes to the Givonim and says, what do you want? How do I settle this debt? Bama achaper. I want atonement here. Reparations? What is it? How do I make up for it? Givonim say, no claim for gold or silver against Shaul and his house. We have no particular other person we want to kill. And David is like, Matem Omrim, Eselachem. Just what do you want? I'll do whatever you say. Cut to it. Vayamru al ha-melech. They say to David, Ha'ish asher kilanu v'asher dima lanu, nishmadnu mi'itatzev b'chol gvul Yisrael, yutan lanu shiva anashim mi'bana, v'o ka'anun l'adonai b'givat shaul b'chir adonai, v'yomer ha-melech aniyet. What do we want, say the Givonim? Shaul massacred us and tried to completely wipe us out so that we would have no existence in all of Israelite territory. We want seven of his descendants, and we're going to impale them in the presence of God on Givat Shaul, basically in his ancestral plot. And the king says, fine, I'll hand them. All right, the following is the gruesome denouement of that story of seven of those kids being handed over, Ritzpa Bat Aya washing their corpses for months. Finally, they get buried. If you've read Yochi Brandes's The Secret Book of Kings, Melachim Gimel, she does a lot with this scene in a very powerful way. Okay, here's the only problem. We have no record anywhere else of Shaul going after the Givonim. So there's like this huge punishment, seven people get impaled, unrequited sin leading to famine, people are starving, presumably dying, but no record. Nowhere does it say that that happened. That's going to bother the Midrash. Okay? For background of what the Midrash is going to do, we need to just see two other things here. Number one, the backstory on the Givonim. Yoshua, chapter 9. The Givonim, how does it come about? The background story here is, the Givonim hear that the Israelites are starting to run a rampage through the land. And they're just bulldozing everyone in their way. It's very clear they're going to win, and they're wiping out all the inhabitants. The Givonim come and say, they show up dressed as if they're from far away. They make their water skins burst open, their clothing tattered, so it looks like they've come a months-long journey. And they say, hey, we're from far away. We hear you guys are the new people in charge here. We'd like to make a deal with you. And the people take them at their word. And they swear, sure, we'll protect you. And then like 3 days later, it comes out, they get word, they're from Givon. They're from right around here. They're from the Chivi. They're one of the indigenous people. And then basically the elders had made this oath to them, and they want to break it, but they're like, we don't know what to do. We can't break it. We made an oath. Like, what should we do? At that moment, Yoshua calls in the Givonim, speaks to them, and says, why did you trick us to say we come from a faraway land? You live right here. Ve'ata arurim atem. You're now under a curse. Ve'lo yikaret mikem eved ve'chotvei tzim ve'shoavei ma'im le'veit Eloh. What's going to happen? We can't kill you, because we made an oath. Even though it was an oath under false pretenses, we made an oath not to kill you, so we can't kill you. But you are going to be doomed for all time, all of your descendants, to be servants and wood choppers and water drawers for the house of my God. They're basically temple servants. Vayasa and Kang. So Yoshua does that. He saves them from the Israelites so that they don't kill them. But he does so by making them from that day forward wood choppers and drawers of water, la'ida, for the community, ule mizbach Hashem ad hayom hazeh el hamakom asher yivchar, and to be servants for God's altar until today in the place that God chooses. They become known later, the Givonim, as nitinim. They're basically part of like the temple janitorial staff. That's their sort of special protected role. You think like the Swiss Guard in the Vatican, okay? Like you've got this group of people, have this special job, they're from elsewhere. That's what they do. Okay, That'll be important later, you'll see. The Givonim apparently work in temple sites. One other piece, nothing to do with what we're talking about, but you need to understand it for the Midrash. Shmuel Aleph, chapter 22. David is on the run from Shaul. Shaul is now at the point he's turned on him. He wants to kill him. He thinks David is rebelling against him. David, in the course of running away, goes to the town of Nob, where Achimelech is the high priest, the priest. Achimelech is a Kohen there, Achimelech ben Achitub. And Achimelech is in Nob, which is known as an Ir HaKohanim. All right, it's like a little shrine type place. All the families there basically are priests. Achimelech doesn't really know that David and Shaul are on bad terms, in part because David lies to him and says, yeah, I'm on a secret mission from Shaul. That's why I have no one with me. Before this passage, David shows up. He's like, do you have any food? Achimelech gives him some of the bread from the little Mishkan, the little temple that seems to be set up there. In rabbinic tradition, it's the Mishkan that's actually here. It spends some time in Nov. And he also, David's like, do you have any weapons by chance? And he says, actually, I have Goliath's sword here, the one you defeated. And David is like, En kamohu tnen ali. That's great. There's no better sword than that. He takes it. From Shaul's perspective, Achimelech has aided and abetted the enemy and committed an act of treason, even though Achimelech just thought he was helping the king's son. At that moment, Shaul loses it. Vayomer HaMelech mot tamut Achimelech, atah v'chol beit avicha. Decrees that everyone there has to die. They're all traitors. And the king, Shaul here, says, kill all the priests of God. Ki gam yadam im David. They're with David. They're against me. V'chi yadu kibon reyachu. V'lo galu et ozni. They knew he was on the lam, and they didn't tell me. But they were unwilling. Like, what do you mean? How can we kill the priests? We can't do that. They're telling us to massacre all the rabbis. Like, we can't allow that. It's crazy. But there was another guy there, Doeg, Ha'adomi, an Edomite, who was on Shaul's staff, not an Israelite, who had reported that something had been going on in Nov in the first place. That's how Shaul got there. He says, you go, kill the Kohanim. And Doeg turns and he kills all the Kohanim, 85 men who wore a linen ephod. Okay, meaning people who are actual active priests. And he wiped out the entire city of Nob. The men, the women, the children, and all the animals. Okay? This, by the way, I just want to say as a side point, when people get very upset about how Shaul has the monarchy stripped from him because he's unwilling to exterminate Amalek. I'm like, how can you do well? That's terrible. So he didn't want to kill, you know, the babies, animals, etc. For that, he loses the monarchy. So aside from internally to that story, I always point out to people, it's very important to note, Shaul had no problem killing the Amalekite babies. He just didn't wipe out the animals. And he wouldn't wipe out a god. So internally there, it's kind of totally screwed up. There's not a moral claim that he's making. It's just weak. But here you see, with no Vira Kohani, he wipes everything out. And with Shaul's problem, and the reason God sees very clearly he's unfit is, this is a guy who knows how to do a genocide. He's willing to do a genocide, but he actually won't do it against Israel's actual enemy. All right, this actually totally confirms in retrospect his unfitness, at least at this point, to be king. All right, that's a side point. That's my pet peeve on Haftarat Zachor for year after year. But in any event, this is important for the Midrash that's coming up. But I want to note, I think it's also in the background, here's the striking thing. You would think that when there's a famine later on and we're like, oh, there's some blood guilt that has to be paid off, maybe it would be for the massacred city of Nob, not for the non-Israelite Gibeonites who we never even hear about Shaul trying to kill. So there's a little bit of like an internal puzzle there, both from where is that attempted massacre of the Gibeonites that we don't hear about, but was apparently so important? And why is that such a big deal that that leads to a famine later under a different king who wasn't even involved? And this seems to fade into the background. All right, that's all the data here that we have to take together in order to now jump into the Midrash. Okay. Now, we still have one last task, which is the actual verse we're going to build the Midrash on. So here we're at the end of Sefer Yeshayahu, and we're in the Haftarah for Shavuot Rosh Chodesh. Koma Hashem HaShamayim Kisi V'Aretz Adom Raglai, Eze V'ayit Asher Tignu Li V'Eze Makom Menuchati V'et Kol Eile Yadi Asata V'Yichu Chol Eile Neum Adonai V'El Zeh Abit. I created everything. How could you build me a house? Part of these images of the universal God creating and sustaining everything that dominate the end of the book of Isaiah. And I don't need your fancy houses, your fancy temples. I just want someone of a humble spirit who trembles to fulfill my word. And now the following line. Shochet hashor makeish, zoveach haseh oref kelev, ma'ale mincha dam chazir, mazkir levona mevarech aven. Gam heima bacharu bedarcheyem uvshikutzeyem nafsham chafetza. I'll render to you what I think is the simplest. I'm not even sure. I don't think the English here captures it. What I think is the simplest rendering of this line, which is, it is a critique of those who are obsessing over sacrificial rites while they are a combination of more broadly immoral and inconsistent about those rites themselves. So they're shochet ashor, they're slaughtering an ox, and they murder people. Makeish. Zoveach haseh, they offer as a sacrifice a sheep. But then they also break the necks of dogs, meaning seemingly they also offer non-kosher, as it were, animals as sacrifices. Ma'ale mincha, they offer up gifts to God of what? Dam chazir, of the blood of swine. Mazkir levonah, they do all kinds of things with frankincense that they think are beautiful, but mevarech aven, but they fundamentally bless evil or false gods, idolatry. You know what? Says God, they choose their ways and their disgusting paths. Gamani of harbita alulehem umaguratam avilahem ya ankarati veino nedibarti vilo shamewe asua rabe naiva shilochafat. Choosing all the wrong way. I'm going to choose their bad ways as well, and I'm going to mock them for what they do. Okay. Plain sense, though, is some version of they're doing these actions that they think are pious, but they're blended in with all this other horrible behavior. Okay? Shochet ashor makeish. Enter our midrash. Shochet ashor makeish. Rabbi Yochanan the Reish Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish each had two different interpretations of how to read this. And here we don't even have all the verses that are background for this. It's just too much. It's overwhelming. So some of this you'll just sort of take my and the Midrash's word for it, and you can look up these verses on your own if you like. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Kol mi shehu gozel et chaveiro shave pruta, ma'alin alav ke'ilu hu horgo. All right, here's the idea. You steal the smallest amount from someone else, it's like you've killed. You deny someone even the smallest amount of their economic sustenance, it's like you've killed. That's the idea Rabbi Yochanan wants to advance. And he is also finding it in a text that is meeting in the middle
with this midrash. The Eid Le Karyan Sagya. And there are many verses that back this up. That's actually a nice way of getting a window into the idea. He's got this idea independent of the text, right? Like, he's also finding it in the text. But when you say, yeah, here's my point, and I'll tell you, there's a million ways you can prove it, right? That sort of reveals someone who, they've got the idea independent of the text, but he's also really going to find it there, and he's going to find it in a stunning way with the stuff that we began with in just a couple minutes. So how does he read Shochet Ashor Makeish? Not as, oh, they slaughter animals and they murder people. No. Shochet Ashor Ki Makeish. Shochet Ashor equals Makeish. If you slaughter an ox, it's like murdering someone. What's the reading here clearly? You slaughter someone else's ox. You take someone else's property. You appropriate it for yourself. You slaughter it. You enjoy it. That's like killing. Okay, that's the point that Rabbi Yochanan wants to make here. You think you're just damaging someone else's property. You think you're just taking, oh, I would never kill anyone. I'm just, you know, taking advantage of them a little bit. Shochet Ashor Kimakeish. And then a number of other verses going to be read similarly. Vayilmod litrof teref adam achal in Yechezkel. An image there of a young cub who is kind of learning to prey on prey and consumes a person. No, vayilmod litrof teref in the sense of someone who learns how to snatch things from people, like litrof et alakochot. Ki adam achal. That's like consuming a person. Another verse from Mishle. That's the way of all those who steal corruptly. They take life of other people. No. When you steal something, betza in the sense of monetary gain, the way of people who have ill-gotten monetary gain is kinefesh be'alav yikach. It's like they've taken the soul, the life of the owner of that property. Yoel, mechamas b'nei Yehuda, asher shafchu dam naki, literally from the corruption of the Judahites who spilled innocent blood. No, mechamas b'nei Yehuda, the monetary corruption, the theft of b'nei Yehuda, because chamas can mean that, lo yakum et chamas be'ish, is kaasher shafchu dam naki, as if they have spilled innocent blood. Okay, so all of those are putting equal signs between two phrases that are next to each other in a verse, where the first phrase is basically a monetary offense against someone, and the second is an articulation that you've actually killed them in some way. Now we get to our main event, the last proof for this principle. Vayomru el ha-melech, ha-ish asher kilam. What do the Givonim say to David when he's like, what do I need to do to release this blood guilt? They say, you're going to give us seven descendants of who? The man who wiped us out. Asher Kilam. V'chi hu haragan odima lahem? What are you talking about? When did Shaul ever kill the Gibeonites or plan to exterminate them? There's no record of that anywhere. Ela, al yedei shechrivet nov ir hakohanim shehayta mespeket lahen mizonot ma'ale aleihen hakatuv keilu hu haraga. This is unbelievable. What does Rabbi Yochanan say? We do have a record of Shaul going after the Gibeonites. Why? Here's the connective tissue. Shaul massacred Nov, Ir HaKohanim. But where were the Givonim, according to the curse that Yehoshua put them under? The Givonim serve Levet Elohai, in the house of my God, Al Mizbah Hashem,
wherever the Mishkan was, the Givonim go as servants. Meaning what? The Givonim were on the staff of the Mishkan at Nob. When Shaul obliterated the entire town of Nob, they lost their jobs. He wiped out their jobs. Yarkonim, Nov Yarkonim, Aitam Misapeket Laim Mizonot. That was their livelihood. When Shaul wiped that out, it was like he killed them. And therefore, the Givonim come with a claim of the guy who wanted to wipe us out and who wanted to kill us. Because now, this is an unbelievable reading on a number of levels, because first of all, you now realize Rabbi Yochanan, when he uses the word gozer, does not just mean stealing in the sense of grabbing something out of someone's hand that they're using at that moment. He is extending it to, you wiped out their job. Okay? Actually making them economically vulnerable is a crime against them. And essentially, the argument here is that the blood guilt that David has to kind of deal with is, when the Israelites swore not to kill the Givonim, they basically also committed to a social welfare program in perpetuity for them. Social welfare, at least in the form of, you know, workfare. but there's a set, they are economically responsible for them. And when Shaul goes into the city of Nob and wipes them out, forget about the crime against Nob, Yerachonim, which that's an act of murder. That's terrible. But there was also this violation of an oath and a failure to take responsibility. It's as if he's like, well, I had to kill these people, but what do I, it's not my problem that they lost their jobs. Says Rabbi Yochanan, yes, it is your problem. And actually that bill is going to come due. What do I think is so unbelievable about this text is it is really in a very powerful way. Again, the model I'm offering of idea meeting text. On the one hand, the idea here is very strong. Strong beyond the scope of the text. Like this is something Rabbi Yochanan is walking around with as a theory of leadership, sovereignty, economic responsibility, and obviously also devolving on the personal level. Like you're responsible for the other people who are around you, over whom you have authority, to whom you've made commitments, etc. That's the idea piece. But the text piece is equally strong, right? Which is a real grappling of I don't see the massacre. There is really something puzzling about that. I don't see where Shaul did that. And I also feel like this much bigger deal of a massacre of Nov doesn't register later. There's got to be some way that those are intertwined. And the Midrash really is integrating those two and then produces this remarkable reading of that suite of texts. That then I'm not sure you know where you begin and where you end anymore. Like, am I really starting with an idea and I found a nice way to put it in the text? Or did I really start with trying to figure out what went on with Shaul and I learned something deep about monarchic and communal responsibility and the intertwining of economic, of life and property, right? The ways in which those are really actually not separate categories, but intertwined categories. It's not quite property, right? It's more like the ability to kind of make a living and sustain oneself. So that's as good an example, right, as I know, that requires that kind of back work of seeing that kind of powerful meeting in the middle. Just so you see, remember we started with Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. So Reish Lakish didn't agree with that reading, or he offered something else. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish Masares Kriya. He would reverse the flow of the initial verse. Shochet Shor Makeish. He saw a different thing going on there. Makeish Shochet Ashor. Orev Kelev Zoveh Chaseh. Dam Chazir Ma'ale Mincha. Mevarech Aven Mazkir Levona. What does he see Yeshayahu was saying? Makeish when they would murder people, the people in the time of Isaiah, they thought of it as nothing more than slaughtering an ox. They would break the neck of a dog and think, yeah, that's just as good as offering a sheep. They would take pig's blood and decide, yeah, let's offer that as a mincha. They would bless evil, foreign god, etc., and use frankincense, or think that it was the same as offering frankincense to God, meaning their priorities are all screwed up on a kind of religious and moral level. You know, Reish Lakish is just another view here, worthy on its own front. But the other thing I think is powerful is, as a foil to Rabbi Yochanan, you see, Rabbi Yochanan is really like advancing his reading, because it's not the only reading in the air. There are other people reading Shochet Ashor, Makeish in different ways. Rabbi Yochanan is saying, no, Shochet Ashor, Kimakeish. That's really what I'm trying to emphasize here. Again, neither of them seems to be the plain sense of the initial verse in Yeshayahu, but the initial verse is also somewhat unclear, right, in terms of what's happening. I'm going to end just with this last midrash. I didn't translate this one, but which will hopefully become pretty clear just by the cadence of it. If you're interested in the background text that's building off of this, so it's in Vayikra Yudalet, Leviticus 14. You can pull that up on Safaria or anything else that you have if you want just sort of the background. The background text here is Tzarat HaBayit, the notion of some kind of mold or decay that shows up in the house of an Israelite once they enter the land. It's being spoken about in the future. V'natati negat tzarat beveit eretz achuzatchem, when you get into the land, ki tavo el eretz kanan. There may be a time where your houses have some kind of fungus or mold in them, which is going to have to be dealt with. It's going to have to be dealt with ritually. And this is a passage in Vayikra Rabbah that I think does two things. One, it gives you a sense of a little bit more of a like lyrical, homiletical mode, what it is to kind of whip up your audience with an allegorical reading of a text in the Torah. We're going to transform a text here that's about all the stages of dealing with house leprosy, right, to use an inaccurate term, and do that while making it about Jewish history. And then the other thing we're going to do, which is what the title here indicates, is combat again, I think, a counter-narrative that has emerged, certainly as the Christianization of the empire proceeds apace, which is Jewish history was a prelude to something else, and it has now ended. And to the extent it's still around, it's some bizarre remnant. But actually, read properly, you'll realize we're just midway through the story in a way that continues, but in a way that's also profoundly accepting of the ups and downs, in particular the downs of Jewish history along the way. So I'll offer you this as sort of the closing proem of our time together that reflects this. Okay, v'natati negat zarat, I will bring a plague, beveit eretz achuzatchem, on the house of the land that you will inherit. What is the house? Ze beit hamikdash. This isn't just someone's house. This is God foretelling the destruction of the temple. Always part of the plan. Hineni mechalel et mikdashi geon uzchem. That's what we're talking about, is the temple here that's going to be destroyed. And how's it going to happen? Uva asher lo abayit. The one whose house it is, in the Torah, it's the owner of the house, finds the mold. Ze HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ya'an Beiti, Asher Hu Chared. The temple belongs to God. God will come. V'higid la'kohen le'mor. The person has to come tell the priest that there's a, you know, problem with the house. God comes and tells the Kohen. Who's the Kohen? Ze Yirmiyah, Jeremiah. Divrei Yirmiyahu ben Chilkiyahu, min ha-Kohanim asher ba'anatot. Yirmiyahu is a priest. He's the Kohen. And what is God going to tell Yirmiyahu?
Kenega nirali babayit. I feel like there is a disease in this house, in my house, in the temple. Zetinofet abudazara. That's the filth of idolatry that had corrupted the temple. V'yeshomrim zet salmosha menasher. Adu dichtiv v'inei mitzafon l'shar mizbeach semalakina ze babia. Pasuk in Yecheskel, reflecting that there's actually some idol in there, and that's understood here to be associated with Menashe, the king of Yehuda, the corrupt king, the murderous king, who nonetheless rules for 52 years, turns to every form of idolatry and reinstates it. That's the nega. There's something ill in my house, God says to Yirmiyah. Here, what happens after that has been identified? Betziva kohenu finu et habayit. The next thing in the Tzara'at HaBayit ritual is the Kohen is supposed to clear everything out of the house. How does that happen here? Vayikach et otzorot Beit Hashem. In Malachim Aleph, we learn Nebuchadnezzar comes and empties out all the treasuries of the temple. The house is literally empty. Vinatatz et HaBayit. And then the house has to be destroyed. And that is confirmed by Ezra, describing Veta Dina Satre. This house was wiped out, the one that now has to be rebuilt. Ve'otzi al michutz la'ir al makom tameh. And what has to then happen to the destroyed remnants of the temple? Of the house, they have to go out to an impure place. So what happens with the destruction of the temple? It has to go to a makom tameh, zo bavel. The Makom Tameh is outside of the land of Israel. The Imei Hogle Levavel. Ezra talking about the exile to Babylonia, and that's the analog there. And here's the turning point. Yachol Le'olam. Is that the way it's going to remain forever? Is that the end of the story? Talmud Lomar. Vilakhu Avanim Acherot. Part of the narrative of the house Tzara'at is that you remove stones that have been defiled and you bring in new stones and replace the ones that have been defiled. This, mind you, is at an intermediate phase of the process. And if then the mold comes back, you wipe the house out forever. But here, the very presence of the fact that sometimes new stones are brought in to replace the old diseased ones tells us that actually in the allegorical version, the stones will return. As it says in Yishayahu, Lachen ko amar Hashem, Hineni yosed b'tzion, Even, even, bochan, pinat yikrat, Mosad, mosad ama'amin lo yachish. God promises to reestablish the foundation in Zion. This is not just about the temple. This is not just about a particular historical event. This is an allegorical reading of the Torah that's read week in and week out. Houses get destroyed, and they're always going to be rebuilt. Because the claim that's being made here, and it runs throughout Vayikra Rabbah, it runs through really in many ways the first thing we saw today as well, which is the idea of mitzvot being a privilege, is that Jewish history never ends. And so you can be destroyed, you can be expelled, you can be exiled. But actually, if there's one basic thing that Rabbinic Judaism is committed to, it is the eternity of the covenant between God and the Jewish people. That is unbreakable. You will always return. You can be in exile a long time. If you're a true Rabbinic Jew, you recognize there is no commonwealth, there is no state of sovereignty that is ever guaranteed to be permanent. But if you're a true rabbinic Jew, you also know you are guaranteed that no state of exile is ever permanent. Because to do otherwise is to sign on to a completely different story, which is one where we did something for a while and then we exited stage left. And instead, I think there's a heroism to so many passages in Vayikra Rabbah, particularly in the challenging time in which they live, that just refuses to accept that and says, we feel actually confident and committed to our relationship with God, to our relationship with Torah, and we're going to weather whatever comes. So I offer you that
both hopeful and orienting note. It's obviously amazing sitting so many years later at a time of Jewish renewal in the land of Israel, in the context of sovereignty, all of its sacred challenges and obstacles, but in ways in which the authors of this text dreamed of, imagined, didn't know exactly when and how it would happen, but they knew on some level that that wheel would keep turning. And so we're at another point in that turn, but we stay with the same text, the same ideas. And I hope some of what you take from this session is how much Midrash actually sits at the center of that. So thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure to learn with you. Be well.